And so, because I didn't have my typical month to prepare for my next topic, I chose one that I actually have done before, and some of you guys in this room probably have heard me talk on this before, but the general rule of thumb, they say, is every 5 years you can talk about the same topic again. And I thought, well, I don't think it's been 5 years. So I looked back, and yes, it's been 5.5 years since I did this one here at this church. And so most of you have probably forgotten. So I figured the little details, I'll just refresh you on them. So I don't feel bad about doing this again. So if I use the same illustrations as I used before and you remember them, sorry about that, but we'll just have to see how it goes. So I'd like to start out by telling you a story. This is a true story, and it is apropos to our topic. So Solid Rock was taking a horse to Anchorage. I might not have all the details on this exactly right, but the general idea is going to be right. So for some reason, we were taking a horse to Anchorage in a horse trailer, and Noah was driving the pickup, and he got up to Turn Lake, and the truck broke down. So he happened to have AAA, and he got free towing with it. So he called AAA, and they came down to get the truck. But they said, well, we can't take the trailer. We can only take the truck. So Noah unhooked the trailer, and they loaded the truck up to get towed to Anchorage. But he couldn't leave the horse. So Noah couldn't go with the truck. He had to stay with the horse. So the truck and the tow truck disappeared off in the distance. And so there's Noah, and you guys know Noah, right? So there's Noah sitting at Turn Lake with a horse trailer and a horse that he pulled out of the trailer and tethered so it could eat the grass. And he grabbed his guitar out of the truck before it disappeared, and he's got his cowboy hat, right? So there's Noah at Turn Lake playing his guitar and singing his cowboy songs with a horse and a trailer sitting there, right? I told him he should have put his hat out, and maybe we could have paid for getting the truck fixed. But so there's Noah, and he happened to be in a place where there was cell phone reception. I don't know if you know, but there's a little spot right there at Turn Lake. So he called a friend in Anchorage, and he said, friend, could you come to Turn Lake with your pickup truck and pick up my horse and my trailer and me? And his friend said, yes, I will do that. And an hour and a half later, here's his friend at Turn Lake picking him up and picking the horse up. And then they finished, right? Okay, Noah had a friend. Noah called his friend, and his friend did not say, don't bother me with this. Noah's friend said, yes, I will help you. So let's talk about our parable today. First of all, I want you to look at your paper, the side that has all the pretty colors on it, right? So here we have an example of inverted parallelism or chiasm. You've heard me talk about that before. And the way we know that it is like this is partly because of the wording in Greek, which we're not going to go into too much, but the topic of each line. If you'll take a look at the blue lines, you'll see that each one of those has to do with giving. So this whole story is bracketed with the idea of giving. So in the first blue line, we have the request. Can you please give me? And then in the second blue line, which is at the end of the first stanza, I cannot give you. And then the first line of the second stanza is about giving, though he will not give him. And then the very last line, give as much as he needs. Okay, so this whole story is bracketed with giving. And at that, I want to go ahead and read through this whole thing now so that those of you that are looking at it, you can follow me, and those of you that are not looking at it, you'll know what I'm talking about. So let me go ahead and read through, and then we'll talk a little bit more about that, about the chiasm. Which of you shall have a friend and go to him at midnight and say to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves. For a friend of mine has come to me on his journey, and I have nothing to set before him. And he will answer from within, do not trouble me. The door is now shut, and my children are in bed with me. I cannot rise and give to you. I say to you, though he will not give him anything, having arisen because of being his friend, yet because of his shamelessness, he will rise and give him as much as he needs. Okay, so there's our story. And this story is, as I said, it's bracketed with the idea of giving, but we're going to go to the center of each of these separate chiasms and take a look at that. So the first one, the two red lines, the center of that chiasm, is talking about a question of honor. I have nothing to set before him. I will be shamed before my friend. And then the man inside the house answers, don't trouble me. He's rejecting honor by that line. So this central part of that stanza has to do with honor. And then the second stanza, because of being his friend, yet because of his shamelessness, this also has to do with honor. And we're going to talk a little bit about the honor-shame society here when we get to this part. But I want you to keep that in mind, that center of both of these stanzas is about honor. Okay, now there is one odd thing in the word order of this second stanza. Though he will not give him anything, having arisen. That is not in chronological order. If you look at it in your English translations, you will see that first it talks about rising up and then giving something, because that's the order that it happened in. But in the Greek word order, they invert it like this. And the reason is because they want it to match, of course, the chiasm and that structure. But the important thing about this is that this proves that this story is authentic to the time and place with which we believe it was spoken into. So this story, because we have that word order, we can be confident that sometime right around when Jesus was walking on earth, right before the dispersal of the Hebrew nation, when the temple was destroyed, we can be confident that this story comes to us from that era and from that place, because it's a Hebraism. So if ever you run into someone who wants to challenge certain books of the Bible about when they were written and who wrote them, there's little things like this scattered through, especially the Gospels, scattered through the Gospels that if you're looking for them and you know what to see, it proves that these things were authentic to this time and place. So we can be pretty confident that Jesus told this story and that the guy that wrote it down, which happens to be Luke, wrote it down pretty shortly after Jesus told it. So that's why I brought that up, that little inverted word order there. Okay, so this story, as we see it, as we have taken it over the years, kind of goes like this in our minds. Here's this guy, and he needs help, and so he goes knocking on his friend's door at midnight. The guy inside refuses to help, even though he's his friend, but the guy that's knocking on the door keeps bothering him and keeps bothering him until he finally gives in, and he gets up, and he gives the guy what he wants just to make him go away. Okay? So that's the idea we have of this story. And we bring to this story our own cultural experience. Now, Noah had a friend. Noah called his friend, and his friend helped him. It wasn't midnight, right? But the idea of a friend helping a friend is cross-cultural. And I don't know why we, in our culture, we depend on our friends. If our friend called us at midnight, Dennis, a tree fell on my house. Come help me. I do not think that Dennis is going to say, you know what, my wife is sleeping, and she's going to be like, oh, not anymore. and I just, my door's locked. I'm too busy. I need to get my sleep. I don't think Dennis is going to say that to me, right? Okay, so why do we think that the people in Jesus' time were different than that? That their friendships were not the same as our friendships. That you could go to a friend and the friend would be like, no, I don't think so. Go find somebody else. Okay, so cross-culturally, we expect things from our friend. Now, this idea of traveling at midnight, this comes from an earlier cultural era in the Western culture that I think pretty much we need to get rid of. And that is looking with suspicion on people who travel at night. So this comes from before the Victorian era in England, but it kind of peaked during the Victorian era. If you were out at night, there was something wrong with you. You were up to no good. And so people were looked at with distrust if they were out at night. And so we have brought this idea to this guy who's knocking on the door at midnight. There must be something wrong with somebody who is out at midnight. And that has colored our idea of this story as well. But that's old. I mean, we are out at midnight now, right? Alaska? Come on. In the summertime, you can sleep in the fall. Okay? So, I mean, I was trying to think of a story, like, to talk about people who are abroad at midnight. And I know you guys have flown out of the airport on a red eye. There you are, sitting at your daughter's house in Anchorage, and you're like, okay, it's midnight, it's time to go to the airport, you know, and she brings you to the airport. We do that for our friends, okay? I gotta tell you this story. When we lived on camp property, we were much younger. We often stayed up very, very late at night, especially on weekends, and people would come to our house and we'd play cards really super late at night. And one night we were up, like it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and somebody knocked on our door and we're like, who's knocking on our door, right? But there was five or six of us sitting around the dining room table. So we opened the door and here's this friend of ours and he's holding three crabs. And he's like, I don't want to get anybody into trouble. He's like, we got to get rid of these crabs. We can't have these crabs. And he goes, and we were trying to think about who to give them to, and we knew you guys would be up. Excuse me. So we had crabs at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was very good, very fun. Anyhow, all that to say, we don't look with distrust on people who are up and around at midnight anymore. So all of this stuff we have to get rid of. James, were you there for the crab meal? You weren't. You missed it. So we have to get rid of this distrust. We have to take away that lens, how we look at this story. It's perfectly reasonable for this guy to be arriving at midnight, perfectly reasonable for the friend to go knocking on the door. So we have taken the story and we have said, we apply it to us and God by saying we need to be persistent in our praying. Eventually, if we're persistent enough, God will give us what we ask for. I have a friend who once told me, we told God what we wanted and we told him we wouldn't settle for anything less. We're told God knows what we need. He just likes to hear us ask for it. And so through that, we have drawn this picture of God as like a Santa Claus. And he has this gift and he's holding it just out of our reach. And we have to jump high enough. And when we have jumped high enough or prayed long enough or proved somehow to him that we deserve this gift, then he will give it to us. Okay. Have you noticed that God's response in this idea is based on our character? God's response to us is based on what we do. If we're persistent enough, if God doesn't respond the way we're asking him to respond, there must be something wrong with me. I must not be enough. I must have to do more. So some of you probably have heard me say this. When we were in California, which I think about that phrase, and just so you know, it's a euphemism for when Ted and I were down there when he was getting his treatments. Okay, so when I say in California, it encompasses all that whole mess. Okay, so when we were in California, there were times when I did not feel that God was listening to me. So I would pray, this has to happen. God, pay attention here. This has to happen. Please, whatever it takes, right? And nothing, didn't happen, right? And now we have like 2,000 people literally around the world praying, this has to happen. Nothing. So many times I felt like God had taken us to California, dumped us there, and then went off somewhere else. And there we just were. Okay, what do I have to do? At one time, I closed my Bible, I put it aside, and I said, God, I am not talking to you anymore. Because you're not paying attention, you're not listening. This idea of it's what we have to do to get God to pay attention to us has like crept into our inner core. And it's hard to get rid of that because I already knew. I had already taught this parable before, and I already knew that God was there already. Okay? But I didn't feel it. I didn't see it. The things I needed that I thought I needed were not coming together. And I jumped right back to my old understanding of this parable. What do I have to do? That was my big question. So two parts to this story. We're going to take a look at both parts here, and we're going to ask the question, what would Jesus' listeners have understood him to be saying? So he starts out by saying, which of you shall have a friend? So the first thing he does is he invites his listeners into the story. Which of you, which ones of you out there who are listening to me shall have this friend? Now the wording of this first part is a question that expects a negative answer. So we see that in several different places. And right around in this part where the stories are being told, and we're going to look at a couple of those in a minute. But the wording is like when we ask somebody, we can phrase it in a positive way or a negative way. So we would say to somebody, You didn't fill my car up with gas, did you? Okay, that presupposes a negative answer. Okay, you can say, no, I didn't. Or, yes, I didn't. Okay, so both answers are going to be negative. So it's the same with the way this wording is. Can you imagine means you can't imagine this, can you? It presupposes a negative answer. So when we get to the end of the first part of the story, we're going to land on negative. We're going to be, no, it did not happen. No friend responds this way. It simply will not happen this way. So we have the excuses of this friend. The friend answers from within, do not trouble me. I won't help you. The door is now shut and my children are in bed with me. Okay, Jesus listeners. They're going to hear those excuses and they're going to laugh because those are ridiculous excuses. Jesus' listeners are saying, no, nobody's going to do that. If he's your friend, he's certainly going to get up. It's not going to happen that he'll say he won't help you. But these excuses that he gives are silly. How much does it take to unlock a door? Dennis, when I call you up, what do you got to do to unlock your door? Okay, not much. Okay. They didn't have the keys, you know, they had the bar. But it can be lifted up really easily. The kids, the children who are sleeping, nobody cares about children. The children are nothing, right? The guy that's getting up, he doesn't have to worry about the children. That's his wife's problem. All right? So she's like, don't wake the kids, Joseph. But Joseph is going to get up, you know, whatever. The excuse is ridiculous, and Jesus' listeners know that it's ridiculous. So when they get to the end of the story, when they get to the end of the first part of the story, the answer to the question, which that whole story is a question, which man of you has a friend that's going to do this? The answer is nobody. It's not going to happen. This story is not going to happen like this. And so Jesus' listeners are looking at the ridiculousness of it. So we're going to jump a couple of verses further down. Turn on the back of your page, okay? So Luke 11:11-13, this is worded the same way as the parable is worded. Which father among you? And the presupposition is the answer is going to be in the negative. Which father among you, if a son asks for bread, would give him a stone? The answer is none. They wouldn't. Nobody would do that. If he asks for a fish, would he give him a snake? No, he wouldn't do that. No, the answer is no. If he asks for an egg, would he offer him a scorpion? The answer to all those questions is no. This is ridiculous. Okay, it's the same with the parable Jesus is telling. The people know that it's ridiculous. And Jesus invites his listeners' reaction to the story by saying, isn't this ridiculous that you go to your friend's house and this happens? No father would do these things that we just read. And Jesus says, if you know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your father do for you? Okay, so that how much more is kind of an interesting idea. What we have is not a picture of a father who is doing bad things and how much more God is going to do good things. We have a picture of a father who is doing good things, but God is going to do more than what a good father does. So the parable we should understand in the same way. Not that we have a man who is refusing to help, but a man who all Jesus listeners know is going to get up and help. And then at the end we have the idea of how much more God is going to take care of you. So there's two reasons why this friend won't respond the way the story is presented or the way we have assumed the man responds. The two reasons are, first of all, he's his friend. And like I talked about with Noah in the breakdown, he's his friend. Okay? The second reason is because of a deep-seated honor shame in the culture. So you've heard me say before, honor shame culture, and I say it really fast, honor shame, and people are like, what's she saying? So I'm trying to do it slow. Honor, shame. So those two are juxtaposed against each other. So our culture is a very capitalistic culture. The culture that these people came from is a culture of honor, shame. And I have lots of different stories that I could tell you about, like the difference between the two cultures. And I think, you know, I still haven't decided which one I'm going to do. I think I'll do the gas station story. So we were in Mexico. Ted and I were in Mexico, and we were staying in a non-tourist destination with some missionary friends of ours. So there's this town, and on the outskirts of town, there was a gas station. And when we would drive back and forth, there was this gas station. It was all green and sparkly, green and white and sparkly, but it was never open. And so finally we asked our friends, what's the story with the gas station? How come it's not open? And this is the story that they told us. So this guy owns the gas station. And he would buy a whole bunch of gas and fill all of his underground tanks, and then he would sell the gas. Okay, now in a capitalistic culture, what you would do when you sold your gas is you'd take that money and your profits and you would buy more gas and keep selling gas and keep making more and more profit, right? How many of you guys are businessmen out there, right? You know that that's what you do. But that's not what this guy did. He would take his profit and he would throw a party for the whole town, 60,000 people. Anybody could come who wanted to come, okay? So he threw this party, and parties in Mexico are these huge, huge deals where they rent banks and banks of amps and speakers, and so the whole town just reverberates with music all night long, like 3-4 in the morning. The town is reverberating with music. And people take their chairs over to the guy's house and they sit out in the streets. And if a car comes by, they pick their chairs up and move to the side, and then they bring the chairs and put them back down. Just huge party, okay? So now, at the end of the party, he doesn't have any money left. He can't buy gas to put in his gas tanks. So he hires himself out to his friends who were at his party. So he honored his friends with his profits by throwing them this party. Now they're going to honor him by hiring him, and he's going to save up his money. And when he gets enough, he'll buy gas, and then he'll sell it at his gas station again. And it just goes around like that. Okay, so that's the difference between an honor-shame culture and a capitalistic culture. The honor is more important than the actual cash. The money is important, but it's important in a different way. Okay, so the emphasis is on the honor. So their question is not, is this act lawful or unlawful? It's not, is it a good personal choice or a bad personal choice? It's not even, can I afford it? But the question is, will it bring honor? So we need to look at the story of what this guy is going to do, the sleeper, what the sleeper is going to do through that lens of the honor-shame culture. So when a visitor comes to a community, he doesn't just come to a single person, he comes to the whole community. And by visiting that community, he is bringing, potentially, he is bringing honor to that community. Now, the community is expected to show honor back to him. And the way they do that is through hospitality. So hospitality is, first and foremost, feeding people. Now, this is across the board in the Middle East. In the honor-shame culture especially, hospitality is a huge, important thing. In the Bedouin society, it's sometimes a matter of life and death, showing hospitality to people. So it's not just, this hospitality is not just whether you invite the pastor over for dinner on a Sunday afternoon or not. This is a much bigger deal than all that. So when the man comes and calls for his friend to help him, he says to him, I need 3 loaves. Okay, now, he doesn't really need 3 loaves. 3 loaves of bread is code. This is a code word for, I have this person that I want to honor, and I am inviting you to join me in honoring this person. So you have 3 loaves of bread. There's one for the visitor, one for the asker, and one for the sleeper. Okay, so he's not just saying, give me 3 loaves and then you can go back to bed. He's saying, come into the party that I'm throwing to bring honor to this visitor, that thereby you will be bringing honor to yourself. So Jesus' listeners, as I said, they've laughed at the excuses that this man gives, because your children can go back to sleep, but you can never regain lost honor. If he does not get up and take part in this, the community honoring of the visitor, he will never be able to get that honor back to himself. So those are the two reasons why Jesus listeners know this is a ridiculous story. The man will get up because he's his friend, and the man will get up because he will participate in the honor of the community. So the answer to Jesus' question is, which man of you has a friend that does this? No one. This is not going to happen. This is simply not going to happen. So with that idea in Jesus' listener's mind, this picture of something that will not happen, Jesus moves on to the second part of the story. And he is inviting them to understand the Father through the sleeper and the actions of the sleeper in this story. So even if he doesn't get up because of being his friend, why will he get up? So we're going to take a look at this second stanza. The first thing that we need to notice about this is the subject. So this is going to be a little English classy. So the subject of each line and the predicate of each line. Do you remember those words from like sixth grade, right? Okay, so the subject of each line will be the sleeper. Though he will not get up, though he will not give him anything. Okay, the subject is the first he, the sleeper. Though the sleeper will not give him anything, having arisen, the sleeper having arisen because of being his friend, because the sleeper is the friend, yet because of his shamelessness, he will rise, the sleeper will rise and give him as much as he needs. The sleeper will give him as much as he needs. Okay, if we apply that sleeper subject to that fourth line, the second red line, because of the sleeper's shamelessness, he will rise. Okay, now, we have switched the subject in that fourth line. We've switched that, and all of a sudden we make that the guy at the door. But if we do that, it destroys the chiastic structure of this story. Okay, so And yet you don't even do that in English. Like you don't just, in the middle of a paragraph, you don't switch subjects and then switch right back. Okay, so we're going to move forward with the idea of it's because of the sleeper's shamelessness that he gets up. So how is the sleeper shameless? How are his actions shameless? Okay, so we're going to look at the word, and it's a Greek word, and I'm not going to pronounce it because I'm not Greek, not a Greek speaker, can't read Greek. I only have to rely on what other people tell me about Greek, okay? Well, this word means, the root word means shame, and the prefix is a negation of shame. So shameless is a really good way to translate that. It also carries the idea of an ongoing condition. So we could say persistently without shame. This would be a good way to translate this word as per Kenneth Bailey. So we could say, yet because of him being persistently without shame, we could say that for that line. So our English versions have translated this many different ways. And I want to say right up front, the translations are not at fault. So I'm not saying that we need to throw away the translations and come up with something new. The translations are not at fault. What is at fault here is our understanding of the English words have changed. Some of the words that we get from like the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries, even though they're English, we don't use them in the same way anymore, and we have different understandings of them. I want to give you a couple examples. The King James and the Geneva Bible translate this word that we have here, shameless. They translate it importunity. And importunity, you might not even know what that means. Importunity means to us bad timing. And that kind of makes sense. This is a bad time for this to happen. But to the people who are reading the King James when it was first translated, what it meant was there's no hiding from duty. So we could read that line then, because of his not hiding from duty, because of the sleeper not hiding from duty. Okay, we don't take that understanding because our understanding of the word importunity is different. Okay, the English Standard translates this impudence. Okay, to us, impudence means sassy, right? Okay, but it didn't mean that to the people that translated the ESV. It meant lacking shame. So here's this idea of shameless again. Okay, the New American Standard actually says shamelessness because of his shamelessness. But to us, in our culture, this is a negative characteristic. Think, have you no shame? Like shame is a good thing to have, right? Okay, so we look at shameless as a negative quality. The New Living Translation translates this shameless persistence. So they have drawn back in the idea of persistently shameless, but they've switched the noun and the adjective around. Okay, so before, the noun was shameless and the adjective was persistently, but now in the NLT, it's the persistence is the noun and shameless is the adjective. So we have a whole different picture of what's going on here. And then the New International Version translates it shameless audacity, right? But the NIV footnotes that. And in the footnote, it says to preserve his good name. So they do acknowledge that there is a different subject. So yet because of preserving his good name, or in order not to be shamed. And now we're going to jump all the way back to the Aramaic translation, which says for the sake of his own shamelessness. So you see with these first, the King James, the Geneva, the English Standard, clear up until the NASV, you can see that the subject being the sleeper fits with all those ideas, all right, especially with the Aramaic, the sake of the sleeper's shamelessness. Okay, so as I said, shameless to us is a negative word. But we need to think of that through the eyes of the honor-shame culture. So to be shameless now becomes a positive quality. Okay, he will not be shamed. The sleeper will get up because he will not be shamed. The sleeper will get up because he will not shame his friend, He will not shame his community. So the two reasons the sleeper gets up, because he's his friend and because he will bring honor, not shame, to his friend and to his community. Now we see in this stanza a formula that God uses in the prophets to describe himself. And I have a couple examples for you. I want to read them. So it's on the back of your sheet. The first one I want to read is Isaiah 54:10. And I want you to notice the formula. See if you can pick it out, and then I'll tell you what it is, okay? Though the mountains shall be shaken and the hills be removed, yet my unfailing love shall not be shaken. My covenant of peace shall not be removed. And then Isaiah 49:15. Can a woman forget her nursing child or have no compassion on the son she has born? Though she may forget, yet I will not forget you. Do you see the those and the yets? Though this unthinkable thing were to happen, yet God's love will stand firm. Yet God will not forget. Okay, so we have that though and that yet. And we have this in the second stanza of Jesus' story here. Though he will not give him anything, having arisen because of being his friend, though the unthinkable happens, yet because of this reason, the thing will happen. So this is how we should look at this second stanza. Not that the man is not getting up because he's his friend, but he's getting up to make the guy go away. Though the unthinkable, it is unthinkable that this man will not, it's ridiculous this man will not get up. But though that happen, yet this other thing will happen. So the focus then changes here. The focus is not any longer what I must do to get God's attention. God is not waiting for me to say pretty please enough times to prove that I'm really serious about my request. The Message Bible says, if you stand your ground, you will get what you ask. So is that like I won't let God influence me? I mean, some of you who have listened to me talk about the Message Bible know that I'm like, okay, the Message Bible is good for some things. Parables, no, not going there with the Message Bible. Okay, so that picture that we have of the Santa Claus holding it just out of reach, that's not what the story is about. That's not in that story at all. But the focus is on who God is, what God's character is like. So God is the hero of this story. And we are right to understand God as being the sleeper who will get up because he's our friend. Okay, God is already acting. When we come to call out to him, he's already acting on our behalf because he is our friend. So Jesus has invited us into the story as a person who has a need so that he can show us God acting on our behalf because he's a friend. And especially because of his character is honorable. So we go to God in his friendship and in his honorable character, and then he will give us all that we need. And it's not because of what we do, not because of our character, but it's because of God's character. So let's pray. Dear Father, thank you that we can come to you and that we know that you're going to hear and that you're going to act. And it's because of who you are and not because of who we are, not because of what we do. And please, when we need to remember that, be there to remind us that it's you. In your name, amen.